The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode 225 for Friday, the 30th of April 2010. I'm Martin Darlington, I'm in the UK. With me is Jim Race, he's in California. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well. I'm a little frustrated, and I'll mention why in a bit, but otherwise I'm doing quite well.
Before we go in, we'll just like to give a massive thank you to more donations. David Francis, Keith Cunningham, Paul Laver, Brian Shear, Robert Kuhn, and Paul Devin, or Devin. Thank you very much indeed. They've all donated this week to the cause, which helps with the bandwidth bills and the Skype bills and everything else that goes in, which is all of which, I have to hasten to add, lands on Jim. Because all I do is talk across Skype and don't do any of the editing or the recording. So Jim's where it needs to go. And just as a reminder, you can send donations to caferace@well.com, or you can donate through the official MotoGPOD fan page on Facebook, and there's a donate tab in the upper right corner.
And yeah, once again, thank you very much, and just fantastic that you guys are doing that, and it really, trust me, it really does help. You'd be surprised how quickly charges can rack up on Skype, and so it's very, very much appreciated, and some of you are generous to a point of fault, but, you know, talk itself is cheap. Processing talk is certainly not cheap, so excellent, excellent. You know, we were going to have two interviews, Martin, this week, and in fact, two interviews were performed. I interviewed Leon Haslam yesterday, and I'm going to apologize now if the sound quality is a little bit off. It sounded great while we were doing it, but unfortunately, when I listened to it back, there is a audio phenomenon called flanging, where one of the speaker's voices kind of develops a bit of a mechanical reverb to it. I'm going to try and fix that up as well as I can because the content, you know, is fantastic, but I'm going to apologize now if it's a little bit difficult to listen to. I also just did a really good interview, with Eugene Laverty, and for the first time we did it over Skype, which was great because sometimes the phones that he have are a little bit muffled, and he can be difficult to hear, and I'm fully aware of that. And got off the interview and went to do some quick post-processing so I could send it to Martin, and the interview wasn't there. And that's why I'm a little bit frustrated. But the fact that I literally 15, 20 minutes ago got off the phone with him, I'll relay some of what he told me to you because we did cover both Valencia and Assen. But in the meantime, we also want to thank Martin. You asked a really interesting question, but it was kind of an open-ended question, which is great because it makes it subject to interpretation by individuals. And it's clear that responses that we've gotten back, everybody kind of reads it a different way. And so the vast array of, and we're talking in-depth stuff. We're not talking, you know, a couple of sentences. We've got paragraphs and paragraphs, and people are taking the time to write in with their real feelings, and it's clear that people are really passionate about this, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the question was what makes a real biker, but what's really come back is what biking means to the writers, and we've had a whole bunch of emails. Some people have quoted motorcycle journalists or motorcycle writers or motorcycling writers, and some people have used their own words. But like you say, it's the one bonding theme or binding theme that comes through is passion. Mm-hmm. And it is not something people do because it's handy. I know in some countries they do. It's a practical mode of transport because cars are not affordable and there's not enough room on the roads or whatever. But to the general sort of our listeners, if you like, the passion they have for it is really mind-boggling. Quite sort of spine-chilling in some cases. You're reading some of it, you're thinking, I'm getting goosebumps off this guy, you know. And you just think, fantastic. And I'm starting to wonder if I could really call myself a real bum. I'm thinking, wow, you know, these guys really have thought about it. Yeah, it's really good. So I'm going to keep that one going. Every now and again, we'll pump out another, you know, hey, guys, if you haven't written in yet, drop us a line and just tell us what motorcycling means to you and what you view. What does someone have to do to qualify to be what you'd consider a proper biker? But I won't go through the list of names because it's getting long and exhaustive, but I do think we might have a show in the making for those long, cold winter evenings when there's no racing going on.
I think we do for sure. And in fact, what might even be fun would be to take a select few and maybe even get them on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
And just have a chat about it. And it's always fun. We always love dragging you guys on. And is those of you who've learned who write into us, you're going to get something back. And so, again, we appreciate it. Feel free to always send us a listener email. You can do that through the contact form on the MotoGPOD.com page. And that was great stuff. We've got about time another MotoGP race coming up. And I, for one, couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah. I think Jerez is always quite special for the season because it's almost like, you know, Qatar was a fantastic race, but, you know, we'd have the Qatar this year. We would have had Motegi if it wasn't for Iceland blowing up. But this is like, and I don't mean to be at all disparaging to those races, but this is like the start of the season proper. This is where it starts going bang, 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 bang. You know, we get stuck into it. It's back in Europe. It's in Spain. And I know the Spanish like to think of it as the, you know, the home of GP racing.
Right.
And it's... I like the track. Well, I don't like the track, but I like the racing that the track seems to produce. I've got to say, I hate that hairpin into the start-finish straight. I don't know why. I just think it's a nonsense corner. Doing that on the PlayStation or just watching it, I just think, but what a heck of a passing place.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it over the years, there's been some absolutely amazing passes made at that corner. Some key season deciding passes, even though it's, you know, commonly early in the season,
and it is some brutal passes as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I mean, on the PlayStation, I think I've probably killed about 45 spectators going off there.
Well, the good thing about it is I checked the weather forecast, and at least as of today, which is Wednesday, it looks like the weather should be good there this weekend. So that is a plus.
Yeah,
I did last week. I'm not even going to go into this in any detail because I guess I didn't really flake on it. But I talked about the Twit GP at Twitegi Circuit that was running on Twitter. And because on Saturday night I was staying up trying to pay attention to the warm-up for the races that were going on that we're going to talk about shortly in Assen, I kind of missed the most whole thing. Those of you that did follow it on Twitter, I'd be curious what you thought about it. And feel free to write into me or write into us through the contact form and give me your opinion, if you will. And I'll leave it at that. We've got some news. You want to fire into that?
Yeah, it was a point being made in gpweek.com, which I find quite a useful resource. It comes out every Monday, covers Formula One, but you get Michael Scott writing about MotoGP, and he points out that with Motegi GP being moved to the 3rd of October, that's in between the Sepang round and the Phillip Island round, which means we've got three Far East / Australasia rounds in three consecutive weekends. And I just had a look on Google Earth earlier. What a fantastic tool it is. Motegi to Sepang, 3,500 miles. Sepang to PI, 4,000 miles. Plus, I've got to get to Motegi to start with and get back from PI after. Someone's going to be clocking up a lot of air miles. But, I mean, that's going to hurt, surely.
That will hurt.
That is going to be, yeah. I mean, I would imagine that the teams will try and arrive on Wednesday, so they've got Thursday to sort everything out before they go into practice on Friday. I mean, that means they're leaving, you know, they're leaving on the Monday. Well, I suppose they're going to go straight there, so they get on the Tuesday. But, I mean, it's not leaving guys very long to recover from both the fatigue levels of the race, particularly if Sepang's as humid as it often is. You know, having done Motegi the week before, then going to PI, wow. But, you know, I mean, it's strange to us in Europe. I think you think, oh, that makes sense, have all three in the Far East and Australia together. And then you look at the distances, you think, yeah, that's like 3,500 miles, London to, I don't know, mid-States.
Well,
it's got to be.
You never know. They may end up much like they did for Qatar to Motegi. They sent, you know, like 90% of their to Motegi. Only a few teams brought their stuff back to their shops in Europe. And so there's actually an interesting article this last weekend on MotoGP.com about how they were putting together all the logistics now and I'm sure that that's already well underway, if not complete, of getting the stuff from Motegi to Jerez, because there were still some restrictions earlier this week, or actually still in the weekend. But it's my understanding that the skies are open, aren't they?
Yeah. As far as the airlines go, I think they're pretty much got themselves back on schedule now with all the planes in the right places. And there were, I believe, Dorna had two or three wide-bodied jets stood by Istanbul. Mm-hmm. If they could have got out to Motegi, and they've now used those to shift, I read some, I think it was 250 tons of bits and pieces just for the kit to get that back to Jerez. But everyone seems to be saying, no, it's going to be fine.
Good. Yeah, in that same article, and I'll try and dig the URL for that up and put it in the show notes, because they had, I think, three jets to bring the stuff back from Jerez, and they had two that were planning on taking sort of a southern loop into Spain, and then one that was going to take a big, wide-swinging northern loop to get back down that way and land at a different airport. So they were taking it pretty seriously. I guess, there's a whole bunch of money that got lost when Motegi didn't go off on time.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it's quite easy to beat up on Dorna, and like, you know, I've commented before that their website's fairly turgid to wade through. But when you see things like that, you think, nah, that's a huge operation. And they reacted quite promptly and quite effectively to that volcano issue.
They did.
In other news, the silly season is getting well underway. And I found this quite surprising, not to hear about, but to have basically openly be talked about, that Yamaha have said they want to slash Rossi's pay due to the worst financial results for 50 years for Yamaha. They're seeking to reduce the massive rider wage bill for 2011. And Masao Furuzawa has said, Yamaha has serious economic problems and I have to have some strong negotiations with Valentino. And my first thought was, hello, did I just hear Ducati and Philip Morris making ka-ching noises? And, you know, Valentino, come and speak to us. We have, you know, big purses. Further to that, Furuzawa has also said that if Lorenzo and Rossi stay at Fiat Yamaha in 2011, which he obviously hopes they will, Ben Spies will be offered a full factory bike for 2011, even if he stays with Tech Trois. It's not that difficult, were his words. And I did think this is a little bit of an in-joke, but Big John Hart in Mississippi, he put a stake of a crate of beer on some predictions of what would happen this year and next. And I suggested that Lorenzo will pip Rossi to the title this year. They'll both stay for next year, and Ben will get full factory support but stay with Tech Trois. I made some other predictions. We don't need to go into that. And I'm just wondering if Big John Hart sat there thinking, damn, I might have to buy that British bloke some beer. What's good beer from Mississippi or Louisiana, Jim?
We've got overseas, we have a reputation for crap beer for the most part.
That's only because of Budweiser.
Yeah, and that would be absolutely a valid opinion. But we've got a vast range of small breweries that put together some very, very fine material. As far as that part of the country, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I could certainly make recommendations. And on Big John's part, I will make sure that we get you something of the finest vintage.
I mean, I am sort of joking apart, but I've enjoyed the banter with John. He's a good lad, and he actually put together a fantastic bit on the What Makes a Real Biker. So yep. He'll get a name check again later in the year.
Absolutely.
Ducati, surprise, surprise, openly courting Casey Stoner to stay for 2011 and beyond. Well, no great shocks there.
Yeah.
And BSB Alton Park, and this is becoming a bit of the curse of the Kawasaki. Chris Walker is going to be running for MSS Colchester Kawasaki, standing in for Simon Andrews, who got injured, of course, at Valencia, when he was standing in for Chris Vermeulen, who got injured at Phillip Island. And I'm thinking, hang on, Stalker's got to be looking at this thinking, I've been offered a factory team ride, but it's a bit of a jinx. But hopefully, I watched him. I did a track day at Alton Park beginning of last year, and I watched him when he was with Rob McElnay's Yamaha, Motorpoint Yamaha team with the R1, and he flew round Alton Park. I mean, I watched him going down what they laughingly call the straight, the home straight, and I thought, well, how's he going to slow down for that corner? He's not slowing down. He's gone round it. Oh, okay. That's the difference. I mean, the difference between, that was one of my first track days, other than at Ron Haslam's school, and I was novice group, and the difference between him and the fast group was much greater than the difference between me and the lass who'd come along on her just past my test GS500 and the fast group. He was unbelievable.
Yeah. So it really is kind of funny. Those people that just do track days, and you know, maybe they'll be running the fast group or the A group, and you know, they're convinced they're the quickest thing on two wheels, and then what you'll see happen is they'll say, okay, I'm going to go race. You know, I'm just fast. I'll go out and win. And they'll get into, you know, a club race, and all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of guys that are faster than they are. And and when you're talking professional racing, it's yet just another level. And people don't really understand just how quick these people are, how quick their reactions are. Also, the quality of the equipment they're usually on. Now, to jump back to what you were saying about the Kawasaki curse, we'll spell it with a K. Maybe all the bad ones fell down already, and all it's left. All it's left is good.
And it is great to see Chris Walker, you know, on a bike. He ran with a Suzuki in the opening rounds, but it was a private team. They've been struggling to get sponsorship, and he's too interesting a character and too tough a rider not to see him, you know, performing. It's sad to see when some of the guys just don't get backing and they move from team to team, or they drop down to, you know, super stock or something. So I'm chuffed that we'll be seeing him there. And the other bit of news, you've just popped in there. Do you want to spill this one about Alton Park? Because it's mind-boggling.
It is interesting, but it's and it certainly wouldn't have happened last year. James Ellison is going to start both races, but he's going to pull out after a lap. And the primary reason for this, as is my understanding of the 2010 British Superbike rules, is that you have the opportunity to throw out your two worst results. And we know that with his broken femur, he probably couldn't be competitive. The question is, can he put in a fast enough lap to qualify so that he can at least put this effort in? So I guess this is one place where the new rules can sort of save your butt. I don't think that was necessarily the intent of the rule, but
no.
It is the rule as written that you can toss them out, and he is taking advantage of that. So,
but it just goes to show, whatever rule you put in, the teams will immediately study it. We've seen it, you know, in Formula One with those diffuser things, and you know, anyone, they will immediately look at it and think, right, how can we exploit that to the absolute nth degree?
Indeed.
To get the most out of it.
Indeed. Hello, this is Jim Ace for MotoGPOD, and I've got on the line with us once again, and I appreciate it, Leon Haslam. How are you doing, Leon?
Yeah, all good.
Good. We talked to you last just after Portimao, and you've had two race weekends and four races since, and so we're going to do a little catch-up. I did have a general question for you before we start, and this is something that I've been thinking about for a while, and maybe you could... I don't quite understand the logic behind it, but I'm wondering why in World Superbike the practice session orders go free practice one, then timed one, then timed two, and then free practice two, followed by super pole. It kind of seems almost out of order, but then I was thinking, is FP2 needed to make, like, last-minute changes?
Yeah, basically, what they're saying is, I think on that one, is if you have a second qualifying and literally 15 minutes straight after free practice, you've got the super pole. And if you have a crash in the last session before super pole, there's not enough time in that 15 minutes to obviously to prepare the bike, and obviously you're going to be the one who's in qualifying. So I think what they do, they make you qualify in the afternoon and then in the morning, and then the free practice, you know, it gives them time to set up for the super pole.
How, in a secondary question then, how close do you keep your two bikes?
Depending on what you're trying to achieve over the weekend, you know, if you've got some things to try, so if both bikes are feeling the same and you can run on both bikes, it's good to have one set up in one and one in the other, and, you know, it saves time during the session, and you can sometimes eliminate things, you know, a little bit quicker.
Sure. Okay, well, let's talk about Valencia. It seems like so long ago, but I was walking through all of your practices there, and you were very consistent, probably not exactly where you wanted to be. FP1, you were 6th. QP1, you were 5th. QP2, you were 5th. FP2, you were 5th.
Yeah.
And so relatively solid, right up there, near where you wanted to be.
yeah.
Super Pole 1, you were second. Super Pole 2, you were fifth. Yeah. And then Super Pole 3, you got on the front row in fourth, which I know that you want to be on that front row, maybe not exactly there. But one thing that I did notice is that it seems like for almost everybody that makes it to Super Pole 3, their fastest times, with only a few exceptions, are actually run in SP2. Yeah. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, basically, what my normal strategy is Super Pole 1, we run the race tire, which, you know, gets us through to the top 16. Some guys have to run queues to get through to that. And then Super Pole 2, basically, you've got to get in the top 8. And, you know, from 1st to 15th, most of the weekend, there was only 1 second covering everybody. And, you know, I went out on the first qualifier and I put it P2. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was like down to P6. I thought, I've got to use my second qualifier just to make sure. And it was a good job I actually did because, you know, I only just got in, even with my second qualifier. But one thing I've actually been struggling with this year is that my actual qualifying tire to my race tire have been within a tenth of each other. And most of the time, I've actually been quicker on race tires. And, you know, a few guys like, you know, Yamaha and Crutchlow and all them guys, they're finding, you know, up to a second sometimes just on a qualifier. I don't know if it's to do with my setup or what, but I have been really struggling with a qualifying tire this year.
It seems like I've noticed that the guys that are actually most successful, and I can actually see some teams moving this direction, is not trying to set up their bikes so much for qualifying anymore, is just to focus on the race setup.
Yeah, that's what we always do, you know. We use probably the least amount of tires to everybody, and we always use the race hard race tires, and that's probably why we're as quick on race tires when it comes to putting in the softer stuff, because, you know, our setup's all about grip on not very good tires. So when you put grip to a grippy setup, it doesn't really give you much of an advantage, where obviously a lot of the other guys are looking at for the ultimate lap time, and then when they get grip, they get a really good lap time, you know. So I think that's the difference between the two.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of the amount of notes that you take to change back and forth between the variable setup, there's a lot of work, and there's a lot of small things that can go wrong if you're trying to put the bikes back and forth between the different configurations, I can well imagine.
Yeah, for sure, you know, and this year has been really strange, you know, 5 degrees of track temperature change and your bike's completely different, and it's literally that it is that much of a difference, and you've got to kind of got to, you know, go out in the mornings when it's cooler and get a setup, you know, figure it out in one session. And in the afternoons, you get a different setup because it's warmer. And then you kind of got to evaluate them two setups to make the right decision on race day, you know, depending on the temperature.
Have you been fairly happy with the tires that Pirelli's been supplying this year?
Yeah, I've actually run the same race tire at every single racetrack so far, the same exact same tire. And, you know, everyone else has pretty much run that same tire as well. So at the minute, there's just one tyre that's quite good. You know, sometimes it's on the borderline of lasting races, but with everyone on the same tyre, it's, you know, at the minute, it's not too bad.
Yeah, we'll talk to that. We'll talk about that a little bit more because there were some interesting choices made at Assen. But let's walk through Valencia here a little bit. That was, well, what can I say about race one? Why don't you just walk me through that? That was a pretty good race for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, for me, going into Valencia, I thought that it was definitely going to be one of my toughest races because, you know, Carlos goes unbelievable around that place, Checa. He was on fire through testing. He was quickest all through the weekend. And, you know, he was definitely the man to beat. And on top of that, Biaggi and Aprilia, really, and Leon Camia, had done all their winter testing at Valencia and was also, you know, definitely going to be there in the races. So, you know, for me, it was them two that I was going to be fighting out races with. And after Norris' performance last year, you know, I thought he might come through good as well. So, you know, for me, it was all about battling for a podium and putting myself in a position. And, you know, the first race, we got about fifth or sixth away, worked his way through to the lead, you know, thanks to Carlos jumping off of it. And, you know, I just got my head down and was pulled away. It was all relatively easy, which, you know, I didn't expect at all.
Valencia has always also kind of been known as a quote-unquote Ducati track as well.
No, for sure. I think there were 60 cars in the top 8 most of the weekend. You know, it was one of them situations. But you know, like I said, that first race, it went down to a T. Going into race two, we made a few minor little changes to the setup just because the temperature changed. But the biggest problem I had in race two was one, it was a two-part race, and I got two real bad starts. And in the second restart, which was a 20-odd lap, I had a brake problem, and literally the brake was coming all the way to the bar from lap one. And I managed to basically work my way through to fourth, but trying to follow people and pass people with, you know, with the brake not really working, it was quite scary sometimes.
You know, I was really surprised at that because the accident between, I believe it was Simon Andrews and Inuzzo, was on lap four, I think, and so they reverted to the prior lap. And I would have thought that they would have done a full restart at that point. Because
I always thought it had to at least cover the third race, otherwise it was a restart. So, you know, for us, it was only the third lap. I thought it definitely would have been a restart, but, you know, it was quite strange that one.
Yeah, and aggregate timing, frankly, not only for you guys, but for the people watching at home and the fans at the race, it just seems kind of confusing in a way.
No, it is, you know, and lucky for me, I was fourth on the road in the second race, but, you know, it kind of made my mind up with about eight laps to go that there's no point in pushing to try and catch the leading three, because to catch them leading three, it took a lot of risk, and then to pass all three of them and then pull a two-second lead, which they all had on me on aggregate, it was pretty much impossible. So for me, it was kind of a lonely race, but with a brake problem as well, you know, I was just happy to see the flag.
Yeah, indeed. And so with the finishes that you had, you still ended up picking up a couple of additional points from that race, right?
Yeah, and, you know, for going into Valencia, I've definitely been happy with holding the lead, and to extend it and have another win, you know, that was I was really happy.
Yeah, aggregate just seems kind of odd. Hey, were you front and center for that kind of bizarre crash from Leon Camier?
Yeah, I saw Leon's second one. He just lost the rear, and, you know, he was pushing too hard, though. I watched the race afterwards. He was on the limit. And the race won the crash again. He just got on the brakes a mile too fast. And you know, he was quite lucky not to take Biaggi out in that first one. But, it was a strange... the second one was quite strange for him to lose a rear and actually not to high-side him.
Yeah. And the crash with Carlos Checa in race one was also kind of bizarre because he basically fell off the bike. He couldn't get it straightened up for the next left and...
He lost the front as soon as he pitched it in, and he was real lucky he didn't go down on the left, but he saved it for that long. There was no way he was getting it changed over to the right, so, you know, one way he was really lucky not to go down, and, you know, it was two, he was unlucky, you know, they didn't actually make the corner type of thing.
Well, I guess the mechanics probably appreciate it, because it wasn't like he tumbled the thing end over end.
Exactly.
All right, so moving on, and then we go off to Assen, which people seem to look forward to less and less sometimes, but, you know, some of the changes they've made. Hey, did you have any troubles getting there with that pesky volcano in Iceland?
Yeah, we did, actually. We had a charity event in London on a Wednesday, and literally I had a flight booked to Stansted at 6:30, and I had a ferry from Dover at 6:30, so... It was literally wait until the last minute, and if the flight was on, we were going to drive up to Stansted. If not, we were going to drive to Dover, and we ended up driving to Dover and having to drive all the way to Assen. So, you know, it was a bit of a long drive and a late night, early hours Thursday morning.
You know, I think anybody that was on the aisles over there probably all had at least double bookings trying to make sure that they could get where they needed to go.
Yeah.
So you get to the track, and we've got a pretty... interesting change. The old sharp right-hander at the end of the back straight has been basically changed to a, you know, 45-degree angle and actually opened up a little bit of curbing, and that section of the track suddenly looked really cool and really fun. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was. It's quite bumpy, actually, but really high speed. It did actually take a passing place away from what was last year's track, but definitely made it a lot more interesting and probably more enjoyable to ride around. You know, it was a big, you know, you definitely needed to be committed to get into that one, and it made it quite fun to ride.
Yeah, Johnny seemed to find, until Troy Corser figured it out, a nice little path across the inside of that one section.
Yeah, he had to get past before he got there, and whoever's on the outside, you know, you had to kind of give way. I managed to pass Johnny into there in race two, but, you know, I kind of got alongside him just before we shut off, so... You know, he was the one that had to give way that time.
Yeah, we'll go to race two in a bit, but very quickly run through practice. FP1 fourth, QP1 fourth, QP2 sixth, FP2 third, and then going through Superpole first, second in SP2, and fourth again, but at least front row, right?
Yeah, you know, the whole weekend for us was good and bad. We had a few issues with setup of the bike, and we knew Johnny was going to be the one to watch because, you know, he'd just been testing there for 2 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was the benchmark, and I was basically gauging myself to him, and, you know, by second qualifying, we kind of got down to where his pace was and was actually running, you know, there was only really me and him that was running these consistent times. So, you know, I felt pretty confident with that. And in the first two, three practices, you know, he went quickest. I went quickest in Super Bowl 1, and then he went quickest, you know, in the next one. And there was nothing in it. And the biggest problem I had in the Super Bowl sessions was is that I couldn't get any faster on a qualifying tyre. You know, I actually qualified, my fastest lap in all three sessions was on my race tyre, which was good for me looking forward to the next day, but frustrating that we couldn't, you know, have a go for that pole position.
You know, you should probably figure out a way to auction off your qualifying tyres the way you're running your race tyres.
No, definitely.
Yeah, one thing I noticed was that Leon Camier was, at least in SP2 and SP1, he was latching on the back of Johnny, and I was just kind of laughing. He did it twice in a row and picked up some great times from that. So
yeah, no, sure. You know, it's Aston's one of them places that, you know, as both races shown, that you can't really get away from anyone. It's dead easy to follow, but, you know, to do the pace on your own is, even if you've got a little bit of an advantage, it's hard to pull away. And, you know, a tow around Aston is definitely a big advantage.
Yeah, cool. All right, so let's talk about race one. And race one has a lot of interesting things going on, not necessarily for the best. Oh, by the way, in morning warm-up, you were second. Had you found something on Sunday morning?
Not really. We made some minor changes, which was definitely feeling a lot better. And, you know, the pace that we had in morning warm-up was quite comfortable. And, you know, it was actually quicker than both the races, the morning warm-up time. So, you know, I felt pretty good in morning warm-up, and, you know, pretty confident for the race. It all went to plan, really.
Okay. And then, so we come down to race one, and I want to ask you about your sighting lap, just where you head out before you head back to the grid to do all the media stuff. When you went out for your sighting lap, how did everything feel?
Basically, I had a funny feeling with the front end, and I straight away said to the boys on the grid, you know, I can't tip in onto the corners, and you know, it felt like a cold tyre. If you've gone out on a really cold tyre, the bike don't let you literally tip into the corners until the temperature gets up. And, you know, they checked the data, they checked a lot of stuff on the bike, and they couldn't see anything. So I thought, you know, it's just going to get better, you know, after another warm-up lap type of thing. And I did the warm-up lap, and it still wasn't great. And, you know, we started the race, and from lap one, I just couldn't do anything with the bike. I couldn't brake. The thing wouldn't stop. The front kept folding. On all the tight corners, the tyre just felt like jelly. And then, you know, it was real frustrating because I got away with them, and, you know, I was still matching their lap times, and the thing just was handling so, so bad. And because I was hanging in there, you know, that probably made it even worse. That, you know, I tried to make a few passes, and every time I did, it overloaded it even more. And, you know, the brakes wasn't working that great the whole race either, which I thought, you know, that might be causing the problems with the front end. And I kind of just stuck it out. I ran off the track two or three times. I dropped right back to 16th. It was one of them situations where, you know, but what the hell is wrong with this bike? This is like nothing like I've had all weekend, and it feels terrible type of thing. And I had a good battle with Norrie and Sykesy and Fabrizio at one point, and I managed to get back up to 11th, but, you know, to say the least, I was very unhappy after that first race.
Yeah, I noticed, and they did give a fair amount of coverage back there, I think primarily, well, A, because the Ducatis were back there, and for some reason they always catch the Italians a lot back there, but I remember several laps where you were trying to catch Tom, and I could see that you had the speed once you were straight up and down, but that you were clearly hesitating going into the corners, and you couldn't do anything unless the bike was up and down. And I knew right then, I'm like, something is just not right.
Yeah, well, obviously after the race had done, I had my big moment at the guys, and they thought, you know, the brakes was an issue, and it's half an hour before the bike's come back to the garage, and they brought the bike back, and I said, there's something wrong with that front tire, you know. I set it on the warm-up lap, and all race, it just got worse and worse and worse. And, you know, they checked the pressure on the front tyre, and normally you run like 2.5 bar in the front tyre, and it was like 1.1. And straight away, you know, then they said, look, it's a slow puncture on the tyre, you know, and then we evaluated all what I'd said before we knew that, and that just explained all the problems straight away. So, you know, at that time, we was going to basically make a few changes and move a few things around for race two to try and improve it. Changing brakes and whatever, and I said, no, look, morning warm up the bike was fine, just put it back to that setup, and you know, and we'll just put a new front tire and then we'll go for race two. And, you know, that was kind of the situation.
Did they find the puncture post-race? You know, even in my club racing days, I remember there's always a danger, small little snips, cutoffs of safety wire that can...
Yeah, it's obviously the tubeless tires, but... it was real strange because they checked the pressure on the line and it was fine. And it actually felt real bad on the warm-up lap before, and that was after they checked it. So, you know, it was a bit of a strange situation.
That is bizarre. You know, currently, and I think next year they're banning it, it might be this year, but MotoGP actually has remote sensors that feed into the ECU, and you can read it through the data to know what your tire pressures are.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I look at that and I go, it's a safety thing. They want to take it out because right now it's being equated to being used with traction control to modify it during a race as your tire pressures change.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to know if you were way low. And I guess the only other thing that could do that is maybe a poorly seated bead or maybe a bad straighter valve or something. Hard to say.
Yeah.
So is the team going to make any changes? They're going to check the tire pressures, you know, before the warm-up lap from now on?
Well, yeah, they checked it before. They checked it on the line, and, you know, it was all the right pressure. But basically, the out-lap to the grid, I said it was a problem, and that's the reason why they checked it on the grid, and it was fine. So, you know, other than it was losing pressure throughout the race, and it was, you know, half the pressure, there was still something wrong with it, even when the pressure was at the right square. So, for me, that's saying there was something... you know, bend or crack or something on the wheel itself or something.
Yeah. Well, at least in that race, you managed to claw your way back up, get an 11th, and you picked up 5 points. So good on you. And then we go on to race two, which was a lot more fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, we got an off-reasonable start. We had a fantastic battle with a load of guys. And for me, the mid-race point, I felt real confident for the win, you know. The guys around me was making passes, but there was no way he was going to get away, and the bike was running really good. But then literally, with about seven, eight laps to go, I thought, you know, this is the time that we need to get his head down. As soon as I started to push, I got a load of front-end chatter. And we kind of knew it was going to come because we had it in Saturday qualifying when we did race runs. Obviously, with us going back to them settings, we thought, well, maybe, you know, that might come back. But then literally... every lap that went by, the chatter just got worse and worse. So, from me being real confident that it was going to be a definite win to thinking, well, now we just need to hang on to the podium. This is getting quite bad, you know. And that was frustrating because it was one of them that I was kind of just waiting and looking forward to, you know, have a good battle for the last few laps. And then it ended up that Johnny made a little bit of a break, and you know, I was just kind of hanging in for the second place.
Johnny ran a super mature weekend. I was really impressed. But you had some monumental battles with Leon, and we're talking, I'm sure there was some paint traded between the two of you.
Yeah. Johnny stuffed it in there a few times, and you know, I managed to get a couple in, and me and Johnny and Corsa got a few good fairing bashings as well, you know. And Athens is renowned not to be one of the best places to pass, but, you know, we passed in pretty much every corner on the track, which definitely made it exciting. And you know, I was really happy to extend the championship after both races, and, you know, especially after a 11th place and a puncture, you know, that definitely should have been a DNF. And it was one of those situations where, you know, if race one would have gone to plan, would have been challenging for the win, and that probably would have set up race two and, you know, made it a little bit easier. But at the same time, you know, to come away with a little bit more of a lead of the championship, we kind of took it. And frustrating that we didn't get the double win that we thought we might have done, but at the same time, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah. You made one pass going into the final chicane where I could swear to God you didn't even touch the brakes, and I think you went underneath Johnny, and I'm like, there's no way he's going to make it through there. And he tried to essentially square you off, And it didn't even come close. And I think Bernicle and Whittem were going nuts in the booth. That was fun. And in fact, I have to say that that race across any series was probably one of the most enjoyable ones so far this year. It was great.
Yeah, I think that's us in itself, you know. There's eight of us all battling for it. You know, last year there was just the three of us, me, Ben, and Norrie. But this year, you know, I didn't realize there were so many guys behind us, but just the character of the track, it allows you to make moves, and it stops you from pulling away and doing fast lap times, but, you know, that's racing, so it makes me good.
Yep, absolutely. And it was nice seeing JT up there, although that's just somebody else to start battling with now, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, JT, he's got nothing to really prove. He's a two-time world champion, and, you know, it was only going to be a matter of time before he got himself sorted out. And, you know, Valencia rode real strong in the race one, and, you know, we had two solid results in Aston, and, you know, that Yamaha, they've kind of gone back to where Ben was last year, and I know the bike's a lot faster, so, you know, more than these next few tracks, I think he's going to be there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to ask you what you thought, because you were a fair bit back from Leon with, I think it was the penultimate lap or very close to it, and you saw him go out. You had kind of a front row seat for that. I know probably the first thought in your mind was, I hope he's okay, but then you're looking up to Johnny up there going, can I get close?
Yeah, well, I watched Kamiya crash. I think he was third behind me in the second race. I watched it on TV afterwards, and, you know, he just got in miles too quick. He was one of them that he kind of jumped off because he knew that he was in there a little bit too fast. But I heard that Tozan saying in one of his reports that the wind got up, and maybe the wind caught him that blew him offline a little bit. But, you know, it was one of those situations, you know, Leon's pushing hard, and, you know, he's got the talent. He's just a little bit eager at the minute, and, you know, he saw me in his sights, and obviously two laps to go, you definitely want to, you know, try and close them guys down. So, you know, he's trying hard, and, you know, it'll come for Leon. He's on a very good package this year, so, you know, it's good that he's battling up there with everyone.
Indeed. And it seems like at least Corser on the factory BMW, well, I guess we only have one BMW team now, is making inroads and starting the challenge. You know, the one thing that I kind of wonder, and maybe this is your opinion, you don't have to give it, but it seems like he has this tendency to fade late in the race, even if he's very strong. I'm trying to figure out if it's tires or Troy or both. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's tough, you know. Troy, as a rider, was riding awesome in Athens. You know, he was doing everything he could with that bike. You know, he has got the speed. You know, it's as quick, it's nearly as quick as the Aprilia. But generally, the bike seems to literally wear the tyres a little bit quicker than most, which obviously is hindering him at the end of the races. But his actual style and his corner, and he wasn't really doing much wrong the whole race. He did seem to be struggling and hanging in there towards the latter part, and he just kind of got beat up a little bit because I think that he was struggling with his tyres more than anything else.
Yeah. Were you a little bit surprised at Haga and Fabrizio's relative lack of performance, especially as compared to the satellite Ducatis?
Yeah, for definite. You know, all year they've surprised me. You know, they started off good in Australia, and I thought, you know, they're going to be the ones to beat. And since then, they've really struggled. They went testing before Aston, and they did really, really good times. It was under the lap record of Mugello test circuit, and you know, they go to Aston and they're nowhere again. So, you know, it's a real strange situation that is, especially when satellite teams are beating them, which, you know, is a bit of a strange situation.
It really is. And you kind of have to wonder, and it seems like satellite teams in World Superbike don't necessarily receive nor need as much support as they do in, say, MotoGP. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out over time.
Nice.
Hey, two Albrecht podiums, that must have been hella fun.
Yeah, you know, I kind of predicted that before the season, the year started, and I was kind of gutted that we had issues in that race one because, you know, to be on the first Albrecht podium and battling up there with them guys, you know, it had been a quite a fun race, but, you know, I'm sure there'll be plenty more to come this year.
Yeah, and you used my favorite Brit term in the post-race conference. You threw out an argy-bargy.
No, it's Aston is that, and, you know, battling with British guys, you know, this is the first weekend that I've got beaten by any of the Brit guys, and, you know, race one was to be expected with a problem, and, you know, we had a real good battle with Johnny, and, you know, he was, you know, what Chips is one of the favourites for the season. It's good that they, you know, he's found his form now, and hopefully, like I say, we can have some more battles throughout the season.
Sure. So you overall that weekend, you did pick up 2 points on Max, but Johnny picked up 25 coming your way.
Yeah.
And so things are they're tightening up a little bit. You know, you've still got a 20-point lead, and it's, 38 back to Johnny, but
yeah.
It'll be interesting. There's a lot of races left, aren't there?
No, yeah, this is nothing, you know, right? One bad race, you know, you can be back down in second or third in the championship. So you just got to keep plugging away, and, you know, these next three are going to be tough, I think. And then actually after these next three, we've got some tests planned. You know, all the other teams, Yamaha, Aprilia, 10K, you know, they're all testing, they've all been testing, so, you know, they're making big steps and improvements where, you know, we've not done any testing since before the first race. And our testing starts after Miller, and we'll, you know, that's where we're going to have some things that are coming our way to improve our package and make hopefully that next step. So, you know, these next three are quite important for the championship. If we can, you know, battle for wins and podiums over these next three, you know, with some testing after that, these next three, and some improvements to the bike, you know, it's looking pretty good.
What's your designated test track?
Misano.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, a great weekend of racing. Tell me a little bit about Suzuki and the Alsterra team a bit, because you seem to have gelled really well. In fact, James Whittam said this weekend, he said, you and Francis Bottas seem like old friends nearly.
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those situations that when you go into something new, where everything's kind of, you don't know where you lie and where people are at and, you know, what the atmosphere is going to be like. And I think just by these first few races, you know, we've had some major problems. You know, we've had big brake problems, we've had a flat tire, and I think just my nature of just kind of ride it like you stole it type of approach, you know, they've took that on board, and you know, the enthusiasm from them and the commitment from them, you know, is second to none. And and obviously from my side of things, that's kind of what I want. And that's what I want to give, and you know, together, you know, obviously you get a lot of respect from that, and you know, we're winning races and we're doing good, and you know, even when we've had issues, that you know, they're there 100%, and no one wants to put the blame on anyone. They just want to make things right, which you know, is fantastic.
Very cool. Well, there's riding it like you stole it, and then riding it like you stole it, and still being able to pull into the garage at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So, the next race, 2 weeks' time in Monza, yeah, with the infamous Prima Variante, which was site of much carnage last year.
Yeah.
Last year, it was Stiggy, and it was kind of tough. Didn't qualify so great. Started, I think, in 17th. You didn't make it in SP2. Race one, you were out with what, I think one lap to go. I don't remember exactly why.
Yeah, ran out of fuel.
Oh dear. Well, you weren't the only one, right?
No, exactly. No, there's a few people had that problem.
Yep.
Now, basically, it was a tough weekend for us with the Stiggy bike. We was down so much on top speed, and you definitely need to be, you know, a level playing field. And you know, I think that's why Max is going to be strong at this next race. You know, he's got one of the fastest bikes out there, and you know, the rest of the track, yes, there's a bit involved to it, but, you know, the speed is a big advantage.
Yep. Oh, indeed. Yeah, and it's got some crazy long straights. You were seventh in race two last year.
Yep.
Do you kind of feel like you have a score to settle with Monza next year, or this year?
Yeah, you know, Monza is one of my favorite tracks. When I raced there in 04, I had some of my best races there. I actually beat Norrie in both races and had a fourth place, and, you know, I really enjoyed the track itself, so to be back there on a bike that's, you know, that's on par with others on speed, you know, I'm really looking forward to it.
Do you feel the history when you're there?
Yeah, you know, the atmosphere from the Italians themselves is fantastic, and, you know, the whole parabolica, the fastest straight in the world and all that stuff, you know, it definitely makes it that little bit, you know, the airs on the back of your neck type of thing, a little bit more.
Did you ever go out and sneak off and climb the banking?
Yeah, I did quite a few things on there. Me and Johnny last year was playing around on the scooters, just trying to get to the top on the scooters. It was impossible. So.
That's what you need, Eugene, down at the bottom with a video camera.
Yeah, definitely.
I have a question from our listeners. How do you strategize? Because you're in amongst such a different group of riders. How do you strategize against all these different types of riders, because you have people that ride real loose, people that ride real aggressive, some that are just very calm. How do you pick and choose? And I'm assuming it's because you learn what they're like.
Yeah, you kind of know what they're like. You know Johnny's going to pull some big move out, and it's not necessarily going to benefit him or the person that is passing, but at the same time, you know, that's what he's like, and you've kind of got to give it in back, you know, just to calm things down. And, you know, Max on the other side is, you know, is super fast, and, you know, he's got the bike on the straights to make the difference, but he's not really going to stuff anybody up. And, you know, the same with Norrie, you can follow real close there, and, you know, you feel pretty safe with him. And, you know, there's a few other guys that can be quite aggressive out there. And, you know, that's what racing's all about. That's what makes it fun, and it's what made Aston even fun, you know. Some of the passers at the time was like, whoa, what, you know, what's he just done that for? And, you know, that makes me lunge back a little bit harder the next time. And you know, it's like an ongoing situation, but you have got to keep your cool. You know, you don't get any points for throwing it away. So, you know, that's the key to the championship. And but it's also the key to, you know, to beat them guys out there. So it is a balance between the two. It's like a controlled aggression.
When you were younger, did you ever have issues with the proverbial red mist?
Not so much, but I just probably didn't have the experience as I've got now. So, you know, the red mist, I've always been quite controlled, as the fact that I never really got et up by what other people did. But I didn't have the experience to retaliate, where now I've got a little bit of experience that I can give it and back, but not make too many risks, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, not to mention a damn good piece of machinery underneath you.
Yeah, you know, Suzuki's real strong this year. It's been quite funny because everyone's like saying, oh yeah, the Suzuki's awesome this year, they've done loads of work to it to last year, but the actual bike itself is exactly the same as last year as far as engine, electronic, suspension, but the actual setup of it, as in the things that you fine-tune, like the compression dampening, the balance and everything else, we've really got a good understanding of it, and you know, race by race, we're learning more and more, and we kind of fell on the setup straight away, which made it good straight away. Yep. And since then, we've got a really good understanding from it. So it's not a matter of that the components have changed from last year to make it this awesome bike. It's more a fact that, you know, with me and the mechanics, we've really got a good understanding of what we need from it, which obviously making the difference.
And I think I asked this before, you guys are using Morelli?
Yeah, Morelli, the old Morelli, not the new Morelli. It's the ones that they ran last year. The Erlins forks, it's not the factory Erlins, it's the one down from that, the customer one.
Okay.
And these are all steps that hopefully we're going to have, hopefully sometime this year and also maybe next year, we've got upgrading electronics and suspension and obviously always the engine development side of things as well.
Did you sign a two-year?
Yeah, I've got a two-year deal with Suzuki, so, you know, it's the same model for next year with Suzuki, and we've got a lot of things to look forward to, which you know, is quite strange in racing. Normally, you know, everything's like on the limit, so it's looking good.
Yeah, it must be always. I'm sure you say to people, "Oh, it's the same bike as last year," and people look at you like, "Ah."
Yes. Now, every Honda's the same as last year, and you know, everyone makes developments. Like the Honda's pretty much the same components, besides they're using HRC electronics now. You know, everyone progresses from year to year, sure, even if it is the same bike. You know, I had the same 999 in England for 3 years, and the third year on the bike was 2 seconds a lot quicker at most of the tracks, and, you know, the bike was the same. It's just everything progresses, you know, on the setup and everything else. So,
true. Yeah. Well, it's great to see that you've come together with the team, and it's kind of nice being at the top, isn't it?
No, definitely. You know, we've still got to keep pushing and keep trying. You know, it's everyone's going to be stepping up, but, you know, it's all good.
Cool. Well, thanks again for coming on, and best of luck at both Monza and Kyalami. How'd you do there last year?
Yeah, Kyalami was good. We actually had a bad tire in Kyalami last year. We crashed in one of them, but had a good battle with Johnny last year for the podium, so that was, you know, another good track for us.
All right. Perfect. Well, yeah, enjoy it, and thanks again for being on the show.
No problem. Cheers, Jim.
Cheers. All right, so let's talk about World Superbike and World Supersport. And both days were actually pretty nice. The weather was great. Qualifying went really well. And it did point to a fair amount of Brits up near the top. And for all of our fans over in the UK, I'm sure you guys appreciated that. Once you walk through at least first through 10, well, walk through the, walk, let's rip through the whole thing. In fact, I'll do that, and then we'll kind of point out the highlights. These are race one results. Jonathan Rea, James Toslin, Leon Camier, Carlos Checa, Troy Corser, Max Biaggi, Jakob Smerts, Cal Crutchlow, Shaky Byrne, and Nori Haga. That's 1 through 10. On the way down, 11th was Leon Haslam, Tom Sykes, Michelle Fabrizio, Sylvain Guintoli, Lucas Gassa, Lorenzo Lanzi, Christopher Mullen, Matteo Baccio, and I really need to learn how to pronounce that properly, Roger Hayden, Max Neukirchner, who was out with a crash, Brock Parks, who retired, DNF, pretty far back, and Ruben Schaus, who was first out. He had a crash, and I believe he broke up a foot peg in a bar. And it wasn't a classic Ruben crash, from what I understand. It was a low side, just happened in the worst place. Now, there's a couple of interesting things here. Leon Haslam qualified on the front row. And as you'll know, because we've already heard the interview, and we'll play it prior to this, he immediately noted that he had a problem, not only his sighting lap, but in his warm-up lap, but it appeared at that point that everything with his tire was fine. Clearly, that wasn't the case. And as you heard in the interview, he basically struggled to make it around. So hats off to him. Leon Camier, this is the first time that he ever finished ahead of Biaggi. He's improving. He's still a little wild. Wouldn't you say, Martin?
I said he was improving, but I that first race, I thought he's maybe calmed down the red mist. For anyone who's seen the races, you'll know that I had to revise that decision, Peter.
But great for him. That's his first time on the box on the Aprilia, and so great there. Troy Corser and at least the BMW under his hands. He led that race for a significant period of time, and led it strong, and really seemed to enjoy that new back section, which, by the way, was very, very cool. Now, everybody that I've talked to, both Leon and Eugene said it was pretty bumpy going in there, but it wasn't enough to unsettle the bike. You did have to be kind of careful of where the curbs started and ended, because it was fairly easy to drop a tire off the track. And in fact, Eugene told me, he and Chaz were watching the DVD of qualifying, or one of the first practices, and apparently Eugene indeed did that at full lean and basically saved it on his knee, and apparently they had a real chuckle about that. God, man, I wish I had that interview. But hey, we'll catch up after Monza with Eugene, so no problem.
But it was interesting what Leon Haslam was saying about, he said, yeah, it's nice, it's faster, but they've lost a passing place.
You know, they have, but there were an awful lot of passes in there. You saw the brilliant passes that Johnny Ray was pulling on Troy Corser, and he did it a couple of times, if you remember, over that additional curbing that they put in. They moved that back about a meter. You saw, I believe it was it Leon Haslam passed him in the middle of that section on the inside.
Yeah. There were some really surprising overtakes.
Yeah. And that's not that uncommon is people feel it out. In fact, they'll kind of, when you've got a new section of track, or frankly, anytime you ride a new track, one of the things that you do is you take alternate lines through these corners to see if you can maintain a similar sort of speed by using alternate lines. Because when you're racing, there typically is always an ideal line on a racetrack. But when you're racing, you don't always get to use your ideal line. There's other guys out there, and they want that line too. So one of the things that you'll do is you will take alternate lines around the track that try to either maintain a lap time or increase or decrease a sector time, but still be able to make your way around somebody that is on the ideal line.
And I think one thing with the improvement in the number of cameras and the angles of the cameras with World Superbike coverage over the recent years that I've started to notice is the variation in lines the riders take is much greater the MotoGP. I remember, and particularly when we went to Catalonia last year, we were sat above turn 12 and we were watching the bike after bike after bike hitting exactly the same inch of tarmac. It was incredible. Whereas, you know, when you get the head-on shots, particularly going through some of the left rights, you're like, well, where's he going? Oh, hang on. How can he go so wide on both corners and still be right on the back of somebody? I mean, Troy Corser is so smooth through those, and it was brilliant to see the BMW looking so much stronger, and yet again, you know, a bit of a fade towards the end. I think he was unlucky to have dropped down to fifth, but no, it was interesting.
To me, this was a great weekend. It really was a fun weekend. And on top of that, you know, there's been a lot of people out there hating on James Toslin, and, well, they're going to get real quiet these days because he is coming on strong, and it's a combination, I believe, of him getting his confidence back, and especially in the front of the bike, as well as the team sorting things out for him. But I think a lot of it is confidence, and he said,
yeah.
I can ride this bike this way. It may not exactly feel like the most comfortable thing in the world, but it's going to stay underneath me.
Well, I'm one of those people. I'm eating humble pie by the truckload at the moment. I remember the show that Guy Anderson did with you a few weeks ago, and Guy very calmly and confidently predicted that James Toseland would be, in his view, the not surprising, but in a lot of people's view, the surprising package of the year. And I disagreed with him. I thought, no, I think Cal Crutchlow's young, thrusting, very talented, very aggressive, and absolutely, it was fantastic to see James Toseland back to his fairing, bashing, confident. It was back to the first half of the 2007 season. I do think the second half of it, you know, there was a bit of a, he was had such a lead, he was protecting his lead and riding a bit conservatively, but the pass back on Leon Camier took him, and he was on the red and white on the inside, and I just thought that Jack Burnicle was having kittens. I thought, there's no way you're going to get past, and he just shoved it in. I mean, brave, aggressive, and the bike was flicking about under him, like, and it reminded me of Casey's Ducati in 08 and 09.
Yeah.
Casey Stoner's the MotoGP Ducati. It just looks so twitchy. So, I mean, the comment I put up in the show notes is, talk about riding around problems. He's just beating that bike into submission. And interestingly, in contrast, someone who I thought was very similar in style, Johnny Ray, looking smooth, consistent, yes, aggressive, but he showed a bit of racecraft, I thought, and a bit more patience than maybe we've seen before.
One of the things I kind of wanted to do, and I haven't had a chance yet, maybe I'll do it between now and next week's show, because I want to sit down and count the number of passes that we had in that lead group. Race 2 was even more nuts, but race 1 was the precursor of what was to come, I think.
Yeah. There were 3 different leaders with 4 leader changes in race 1.
Yeah.
It felt like more.
Well, it was everything that was going on behind. I mean, And we had for race 1 for the longest time, I think there were 8 bikes in the lead pack.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that World Super... Oh, 8 bikes in the lead pack, and of the first 6 bikes, and I believe James Whitten actually commented on this, each one was a different brand. Each one was a unique brand. Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if you managed to see the British Eurosport coverage, but they had Carl Fogarty in the studio, which was interesting. He's so calmer than he used to be. He's actually nice about some people, which was refreshing. But you think back to when it was, you know, people would slate it as the Ducati Cup, and it is refreshing to see, you know, different manufacturers. But the interesting thing is, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more in detail later, is the Ducatis at the front ain't the factory ones.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. There was an interesting bit of news that I want to get verified first to find out how valid it is, but I had read that Altea Ducati was actually asking for some additional freedoms for the Ducatis, and I'm like, you know what? We've got some pretty good parity right now. You guys are beating the factory boys. Let's just leave things as it is for the time being.
Yeah, be happy with what you've got. Well, yeah, be happy with what you've got at the moment, yeah.
And frankly, they've won 2 races this year. So, yeah, they're 3rd in the Constructors' Championship. But you don't always get it all, guys, you know. And if Infrant or the FIM does decide to hand you some sort of, you know, handout, it's going to be a lot of people are going to, you know, pointing fingers and go, oh, well, here we go again. So
yes.
I say we let it play out. You mentioned a couple, at least 1 or 2 other things about Cheka. And, you know, they kept saying Cheka was a danger man. And he was running really well, but he never really figured into the podium area, if you will. But he was haunting. He was haunting all the way, and he was just waiting for somebody to make a mistake, which the guys at the front pretty much didn't. They didn't run away with it. The gaps were pretty small, but in the end, that was a fun race. I had a great time.
Yeah, I've just got to share this. This is from the World Superbike website, the results page, the race highlights, and you've got a little sequence here. 12:15, Chaus crashed, rider okay. 12:15, Chaus rejoined. 12:17, Chaus crashed, rider okay. 12:17, Chaus rejoined. 12:18, Chaus technical problem. And I just read that, and I thought, Oh, bless him. Technical problem, well, possibly because he's crashed twice. But, I mean, hats off to Ruben. Two crashes, back on, keep going. Damn, crashed again. I've not been able to find out, like you said earlier, that obviously there was some damage to the bike, but what exactly happened to him, I'm not sure.
If you've ever I've ridden a bike back to the pits after a crash before when bits and bobs were bent, right?
Mm.
Well, when they're literally broken off, like let's say the accelerator side clip-on is broken off, you can ride a bike like that. Essentially the only thing that you're doing is you're kind of twisting it to, you'll use the front brake lever as literally a lever to twist the grip, and then you do all your steering with your left hand. But if you've also not got, like, let's say he lost the rear brake lever, I can see it crashing real easy, even if you hit, like, a little pothole or something.
Yeah.
But you're right. It is funny.
I remember seeing James Toseland in his World Superbike, second World Superbike Championship year in 07, crashed, I think, at Manicourt. And he was stood up on the pegs, punching a brake lever, or I think it was a brake lever to get it, or a clutch lever to get it back into, bend it back so he could use it, and carried on and scored enough points and went on to win, you know. And you just think, yeah, that's battlefield repair at its best.
Just, ladies and gentlemen, one of those little stories that we pull out of our, our spare brain cells. Okay. Let's run on to race two. We did have the Super Sport race in the middle of that, but we'll do World Superbike and then we'll go to Super Sport. Go ahead and run through our finishers there.
Johnny Ray scoring his first ever double, followed by Leon Haslam, who had a fully inflated front tire this time at 30 PSI rather than 11. James Toseland for his second podium of the day. Max Biaggi right on his tail. Troy Corser again, really unlucky to a degree to not be able to push higher than the fifth. Carlos Checa, Jakob Smerts, second top 10 finish. Well done, Jakob. Shaky Byrne, Max Neukirchner, and Ruben Chaus in 10th. Lucas Scassa, Michel Fabrizio, Sylvain Gintoli, Christopher Mullen up in 14th. So obviously getting better, or hopefully, I don't mean getting better as in improving in skill, but getting better as in mending. Matteo Biocco, Roger Lee Hayden, and Brock Parks. And then we had Leon Camier, bless him, two laps to go, crashed. Cal Crutchlow retired. Noriyuki Haga retired with a mechanical. Lorenzo Lanzi crashed, and Tom Sykes crashed. In fact, Tom Sykes got wiped out by Lorenzo Lanzi on lap one, which leaves us with the World Championship point standings. Leon Haslam still leading with 148 points, 20 ahead of Max Biaggi on 128. Johnny Ray shooting up after those double headwinds with 110. Carlos Checa, 103. James Toseland, 86. And so on and so forth down to our friend that we're not sure how to pronounce, Matteo Biocco. Biocco? Biocco. Double C, I think it's Ch. Ray Corser, Toseland, Checa, same comments for race one, really.
Yeah,
James Toseland was just phenomenal. But Johnny Ray's maturity suddenly seems to have... He's had a maturity injection. He kept his head. I thought he ran an awesome race. Leon Camier was doing really well again. But again, this sort of strange, out-of-nothing crash.
Yeah, I mean, he was pushing it, and probably pushing it a little bit harder than he needed to, because at the time that happened with two laps to go, Johnny was about maybe a second to a second and a half out, and Leon Camier had about a second to a second and a half over Leon Haslam in the trailing group. And so I asked Leon Haslam about that crash, and he said, yeah, he basically just barely slipped off the track and he was in the dirt, and it was a very spectacular looking crash. And not so much from a body's perspective, because really Leon just slid, but the bike tumbled like crazy. And in fact, I read, or somebody told me after the fact, that because, you know, Aprilia is still very impressed with his gusto in doing this and, you know, hard in getting to the top. So what they did is they gave him a broken rotor as an award for the race. And they said, this was the best part we had left because the rest is now in the bin.
Bless him. But I mean, he does seem to be a good crasher. And I don't mean that to sound flippant, but he manages not to be flipped. I mean, he's 6'2", I think, and he's quite a tall, gangly fella, and you think if he starts to flip, he's going to hurt himself. There's a lot of leverage being applied to femurs and tibias and fibias and the like. But he does seem to be able to come off at very high speed and just slide along. And as you pointed out last week from Valencia, you know, he can set his leathers on fire.
Yeah.
But he just gets up and trots off and goes, oh, damn.
Yep. And so the big story of this race, really, was Haga out. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Fabrizio in 12th. And so essentially what you've got is the privateer Ducatis by far, you know, with Schmertz. One point I make about Schmertz, he's classically known as a great qualifier, but never a good runner. But Assen is the one place that he belies that. He's had great finishes here. He's been on the box before. And so we'll tease him everywhere else, but he did a great job here. And, yeah. So hats off to him. And it was nice to see at least race two, Max Neukirchner moving back up again a little bit, at least in the top 10. And that's great. That means he's getting his mojo back as well as his physical health.
Can that be just the switch from Suzuki to Honda, or do you think there's a degree of the injuries he had last year? Because let's face it, he had a horrible injury at Monza, which was nothing to do with him, as in fault. Then on the way back from that, he had another horrible one. He broke his back, I think, didn't he, in testing?
Yeah, well, it wasn't that too bad. I think he cracked a vertebrae. But
right.
There's no reason, if Leon Haslam can win and put his bike up there, you always have to kind of look at it like that. I certainly want to see him continue to progress through the ranks and catch back up, because personally, I really like Max Neukirchner. I think he's a great rider.
Yeah. Going back to the Xerox Ducati thing, you've got three satellites coming ahead of the first Xerox, which was Haga in race one, four in front of Fabrizio in race two.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd written this in the show notes early in the week, can it really just be the loss of Davide Tardozzi? But then MCN points out today in this week's paper that it's not just Davide Tardozzi, because he took a whole bunch of engineers with him from Ducati across to BMW. But it does sort of maybe, that's the only thing I can see that's different.
Yeah, it is that. And one man does not make a team. However, they can provide the binding agent that will pull a team together and the direction. And I think that's what he's got. And I think it's just going to take a bit for the Factory Corsa team to get up to speed. I mean, the only other thing that you can look at is say, okay, as an alternative, is that, you know, Haga's giving up or Fabrizio's back to his streaky ways. And who knows? I think we'll find out after a bit. We will have to see. We will have to see.
For me, that was the weekend of the season so far. I thought it was three fantastic races.
Yeah,
and, of course, the middle one, which we're covering third,
yeah.
World Supersport.
I thought race two of World Superbike was the best race we'd had so far this year.
Definitely. I was absolutely leaping about watching that.
Me too. So, World Supersport, and I really can't complain about the results. I'm overjoyed that I got to talk to him. I'm underjoyed that you guys aren't going to hear it, so I'll try and pass on to you what he said. And when I catch it back up with Eugene post Monza, we'll catch him back up on this race. But the bottom line is Eugene won, and it's the same track that he won at last year. At least one of the other protagonists that he had to fight with last year, Yoann Lescors, came in second. Keenan Safuoglu came in third. Chaz Davies, good for him, fourth.
Three.
Yeah. Matthew Legrieve. I'm sorry?
Fourth, but 21 seconds behind Keenan.
Exactly. Exactly. Those three were definitely in a three aliens, if you will.
Yeah.
Yes, we had Chaz Davies, Matthew Legrieve, Robin Arms, which is good for him. They were going on and on about his red helmet on British Eurosport. And he knocked anybody over, which was great. Gino Rea continues to progress. Katsuaki Fujiwara seems like he should have been doing better. Massimo Rockley, Miguel Praia, Alexander Lund, Jason DeSalvo, Danilo Delomo, Bastian Chazot, and then into some lappers, Paolo Cazzola, Imre Toth, and then out
was Fabien Frey. David Salom crashed as well as Michele Pirro. And to be honest, I didn't find the World Supersport race as exciting as last year because it really came down to final chicane finish last year. It's Pippa's birthday, by the way, so a big MotoGPOD happy birthday to Pippa.
I would sing happy birthday, but we'd lose loads of listeners, so I better not.
Yeah, we want to get a little bit more information for the end of the show.
There were some great shots of Brains and Simon Buckmaster in the team, in the not the pit, but you know
the side Bucks, yeah.
Yeah, and getting really excited, and the other thing I did like about British Eurosport, there was some good coverage of the battles going on behind, and Chas Davies mixing it up with Robin Harms and James Whitson and Jack Burnickel going, "No, Chaz, what are you doing? No, that's Robin Harms.
Yeah.
That's why he wears that red helmet, so everyone knows. That's like, danger. No, what are you doing?" And Chaz was like, "No, I'm going past him." And there was a brilliant three-way battle between Gino Rea, Katsuaki Fujiwara, and Massimo Rocoli. And those three, because all three bikes looked quite similar. They're all outside of basically white with red bits.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just chop and change and chop and change and chop and change. And that really chuffed that Gino Rea came out on top of that one.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah, it was very cool. And that was actually a classic last corner one. So that was fantastic. Where does that leave us? Well, because of Eugene's gaffe at Portimao, which frankly, the last thing you want to have happen at your home race is be unable to finish the race. It was a real drag for him. But with this win, it does pull him back up again. So we've got the scores with 85, Safuaglu at 77. Eugene Laverty at 66, Chaz Davies at 46. So he's creeping up there, and I was joking with Eugene. I said, "Are you worried about him yet?" He's like, "Nah." those guys talk and hang out all the time off track, so they get along quite well. Interesting that Harms is very quietly snuck into fifth. Rea is sixth. Salome is seventh. Foray is eighth. Rocoli is ninth. And Fujiwara is tenth. Surprisingly, my early season pick, Pirro, has been, we quite often see him up near the front, but Eugene and I have both come to the theory that Tenkata is using him as he's quick. They're using him as a foil in a way by sending him out quick, having him mixed up amongst the front runners. Because ultimately what happens pretty much every race is one of two things. He either fades back pretty quickly after creating whatever chaos he can near the front, or he crashes out. And that's probably a harsh thing to say, but teams have been known to do harsh things in order to get their way. And there's no doubt that Tenkata want that title back. They held it for so long. The big spoiler here is, of course, Eugene, but the big one that everybody knew going into this season was going to be Johan Lescors. That team has just completely gelled, and nobody's really used to seeing the Kawasaki consistently win races and be on the box. It's been a while. So for me, it's...
You've said this all along, that in the 600 form, it's a great bike.
It is.
It's when they cram a 1,000cc engine in, it ain't so good.
Yep. Well, there's talk, and all I'm going to say is it's talk, because there's always rumor and speculation like this, that 2011 is supposed to be the year where Kawasaki completely revamps the ZX-10R. And they should, and I hope they do, and in fact, the other part of that rumor is the reason that guys like from Vermeulen and even, Hayden and pretty much anybody else that is currently on this year's ZX-10R are there because they've been promised that they're going to have much, much better bikes in 2011. Well,
yeah, and a say in the development of them in Chris Vermeulen's case, of course.
Yeah, but the bottom line is teams say that kind of thing to riders all the time. And in this economy, who knows if they're going to have the financial wherewithal and R&D power to do that. They need to. They really do. But we will have to see. Let's zip through the rest of this and get out of Dodge. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Okay, there's some news regarding the Silverstone MotoGP and Riders for Health. You can buy a ride on the back of the Desmos Sedici two-seater MotoGP bike, piloted by Randy Mamola. and be one of the very first MotoGP bike, or on one of the very first MotoGP bikes to go round the new Silverstone circuit. If you've been to a European round, or I believe they probably do it in America as well, don't they? Mm. You'll see these poor, terrified people hanging for grim death on the back of these things. For more information, you need to contact Martin Cook by calling, if you're from overseas, +44 1604 889 570, or in the UK, that's obviously 01604 889 570, or email mcook, the letter M for Martin, cook at riders.org. There is a rider on it, or a caveat, that riders have to be under 90 kilos, 14 stone, and undergo a full medical check prior to the ride. So if you've just come out of hospital after a triple heart bypass and you weigh 21 stone, you're probably not going to get taken on. For BSB Alton Park this weekend, I'm only going to make race day, unfortunately, on Monday the 3rd, and we're going to do a meet and greet at 10:15, which is just after XR 1200 qualifying, which I've just got to see, outside the Checkers Cafe. We'll be there again after BSB Race 2, same place for thought collecting. Now, the weather forecast, if it's a bit warmer than forecast, I'll be in a yellow MotoGP OD t-shirt, or if it's as cool as the forecast is currently saying, with a bit of a biting northerly, you may have to look for a black with red and white trim Jorge Lorenzo fleece jacket. It's got Lorenzo across the back and the Exfuera badge on it. I'm sorry to say Sharon isn't going to make it because there's a charity commitment, a charity event she's attending that day. But one of the paramedics we work with, Ian Roberts, is going to come along. And I haven't told him I'm doing a meet and greet with the podcast listeners. So he's probably stood there going, why are these people talking to you? Who are they? But he's a lovely fan. He's got a very, very nice Aprilia Falco. So you can follow him to the car park and admire it. It's nicely fettled, as he likes to say.
Cool.
And you've got a couple of things coming up, Jim.
Yeah, a couple little things. Looks like I might be co-hosting with Moto Liam, who's been here on MotoGPOD more than a few times over the years. He is currently doing a show with On the Throttle, which is an online TV show, if you will. And he does this basically every Monday or Tuesday after AGP. And we're going to do one after Jerez. I think we're going to do that on Tuesday night, and I will have more information for you. You will actually be able to see me, which is a little frightening unto itself, and Liam having a little chat live on. And the shows are kind of cool because they're usually about an hour and a half long, and of which half an hour is usually dedicated to live questions. So you can type them into a chat room and they'll be sent on to us.
And they're wonderfully unstructured.
They are wonderfully unstructured. And the nice thing is, you know, quite often you know who the people are. We're quite willing to take a joke, but we do have sort of a question moderator. So, but anyway, it's going to be my first time on doing that, and I'm really excited about that. In addition, and I'll have more information on this, I'm going to be at the AMA races, which includes the TTX GP, the first round of that in the U.S., at Infineon Raceway, also known as Sears Point, as us old-timers like to call it, in California, USA, on the weekend of May 14th through 16th. It's possible I will only be there on Sunday. I might do Saturday and Sunday. I'm not sure yet, but I will plan a meet and greet there as well because I know we've got a bunch of Bay Area fans. And I think that is about it. Again, really sorry to Eugene, frankly, and I really appreciate it when he and Pippa helped me get this set up, and so I hope I did you justice, Eugene. It's sometimes technology bites us in the butt, and it is what it is. But we're going to have Leon on here, and again, I'll apologize for the quality of the audio, but if you take the time to listen through that and just kind of pretend that you can't hear the little squeaks and squawks, you're going to find there's a whole bunch of really good information. So once again,
really, really good interview that was.
MotoGPOD fans and Martin, I'd like to thank you all very much for participating and listening to the show, and please make sure you write in. Let us know what you're thinking, and I hope people hook up with you, Martin, this weekend at Alton Park.
We've got, between now and, goodness me, mid-August, there's only one weekend where there isn't either World Superbike or MotoGP.
Good.
I like that. And only one double weekend, which is the 25th, 27th of June, where we've got Aston MotoGP and San Marino World Superbikes, where you won't get any sleep, Jim.
thank you, everybody, and we will be talking to you next week.
Good night, all.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGP OD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.
3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the motorcycle knows wrong, bang, 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 bollocks. Right, try that one again, shall we?